The government releases a devastating new climate report. What you need to know just ahead. Good Monday morning. And live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and just ahead, what the new federal climate report, the most comprehensive to date, means for Florida and the Southeast. You can get on the line now. Join the conversation, 549-2937. Then later, how to do Cyber Monday, it's today, the right way. Plus, Culpepper as the Jags suffer their seventh straight loss. Ooh, all of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, a new federal climate assessment report is out, the most comprehensive to date issued by the government. The Trump administration released the climate assessment on Black Friday, presumably to lessen coverage of its serious and alarming findings. However, 13 federal agencies agree climate change has already wreaked havoc on the United States. And the worst is yet to come, with billions in economic losses expected this century if nothing further is done to reduce emissions. There is so much to get into, and so we're lucky right now to have John Upton on the show. He's features journalist for Climate Central, and he covers global climate change. He's on the line from the New York area. Hi, John. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. Have you heard about the new climate assessment? What are your questions, concerns, particularly for the effects that we'll see here in Florida and the Southeast? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJackson. John, this report is blunt and it's disturbing, and it paints a dire picture of devastation, global devastation, if the world doesn't get more serious about reducing emissions that are causing a warming planet. This report is backed by 13 federal agencies, and what's notable is that it frequently contradicts the Trump administration and the White House, which is ostensibly backing this federal climate report. And so let's begin with the top line findings from the National Climate Assessment, beginning with the fact that extreme hot weather is getting more common and cold weather more rare. Can you talk about that and also explain why this is happening in spite of the fact that we're seeing an extreme cold snap in the Northeast right now?
Sure. So what makes this report extraordinary is the depth of it. We're talking about 1,600 pages, a real overview of, the latest climate science. And it talks about impact nationally, actually, and it breaks it down regionally. So there's a big Southeast region in there. But I think the most interesting finding from this huge report is that the impact on Americans are already being felt quite profoundly, quite strongly. And it does go into some detail in the report about the risks in the future if we continue to release pollution like we're doing right now, which traps heat, which melts ice into the oceans, which raises sea levels, which helps fuel storms, which helps fuel heat waves, which makes us more vulnerable to disease transmission from insects. So it paints a very scary scenario for the future as these impacts continue to get worse. But what it also does is it outlines the many ways that Americans are already feeling the impact of climate change.
It's 549-2937 to join us. That's something that is evident as you read through this report, John. We're experiencing these effects right now. And certainly people on the West Coast who've just been through the devastating wildfires in California can attest to that. Wildfires in the Southwest are expected to double over this century due to climate change. And then also the other most disturbing finding, I think, is that rising sea levels are going to necessitate mass migrations away from the coast, and coastal cities aren't doing nearly enough to prepare for this managed retreat. We're talking about tens of millions of people that will have to leave their coastal properties within this century. Just looking at some of the numbers, shoreline counties hold about 49 million housing units, and we're talking about homes and businesses worth up to $1.4 trillion. But flooding from rising seas and storms is likely to either destroy those properties or make them unsuitable for use. We're talking really by the middle of this century. And so sitting here in Florida with all of our coastal property, this is a dire roadmap of what is ahead for the Sunshine State if nothing is done to mitigate or to adapt or to combat this problem. And so paint a picture for Floridians, John, what they can expect over the next few decades.
Look, you're absolutely correct. The findings in here are very bleak and they're very alarming. We're already seeing across coastal America, we're seeing communities have to shift away from coastlines as erosion gets worse from storms that are getting worse and as sea levels rise and as land sinks. But what this report really shows us is that there's really very little being done about it locally or nationally when it comes to trying to adapt to some of these impacts. So these impacts can be managed. We can accelerate the transition away from fossil fuel toward cleaner energy sources. We can be thinking more holistically at the municipal levels as to how do we start preparing to reduce risks by moving people out of harm's way? How do we finance that? How do we tackle issues of equity when you start making decisions about which neighbourhoods will be protected and which will not? What really comes through to me in this report is the fact that this planning is simply not happening. We're kind of closing our eyes to the threats, and it does highlight a lot of very exciting early work that's happening across the country when it comes to adapting to some of these changes. And it actually, the report contains a whole chapter kind of analysing and taking some lessons from these early examples. But this report is very clear in its message that we need to do more. We need to do more to slow climate change, and we need to do much more to protect ourselves from it. In Florida, you're absolutely right. There's a lot of coastal vulnerability. The storms are getting more intense because of climate change, so that brings additional flooding and also wind damage threats. But there's a whole laundry list of risks that are outlined in one of the chapters, chapter 19 in this report, that are relevant to your area, including, you know, disease transmission, economic risks, tourism, the reef. There are a lot of risks coming our way, and it would be very helpful if we started to do a better job of planning for it.
What are some examples of what could be done in terms of adaptation, planning, and mitigation that unfortunately we are not seeing nearly enough of in Florida, particularly northern Florida? Southern Florida has gotten a lot more proactive, but what are some examples that you think our leadership in Florida should be looking at that they are not looking at?
I think if you look at some parts of this country, you'll see zoning rules and regulations that strongly discourage house building in vulnerable coastal areas. That's a very good place to start. It's good to start having meetings and just starting to talk about what do we do about these really vulnerable properties that keep on being flooded or that are now teetering very close to the sea edge in your area. You know, is this something that we want to be spending money on, public money on, to help property owners, kind of abandon those properties and then turn them into parks with wetland features that can help protect against storm surges and high tide flooding? Do we need to be shifting our roads? You know, what are the infrastructure decisions that need to be made to get a lot of our money out of harm's way? These are conversations that are happening elsewhere in the country, around the Bay Area in California, certainly the Mid-Atlantic, certainly Southern Florida. But there's a lot of conversations that have to be had, and there have to be actions, and we have to start thinking about how can we discourage this really dangerous kind of construction of housing and infrastructure in areas that we know are going to be inundated just in the coming decades, even in the coming years, actually.
It's really extraordinary to see the building just continuing apace along the coast, and long-term planning organizations, people that I know that work in those groups, one, for example, the Northeast Florida Regional Planning Council, their leadership will tell you that when they try to talk about these long-range issues with policymakers and business leadership in this area, that they have learned over the years not to even use the phrase climate change when they go in and meet with people, John, because they are so often sitting down across the table from people who don't believe the science behind climate change. And so they will use the phrase sea level rise instead as a way to try to get a dialogue going about this stuff. And so the dynamic to me is just simply extraordinary when you're trying to plan for what the world consensus of science says is happening, and you're facing vested interests that don't want to accept this science and don't want to make these changes. But as this report says, the cost of doing nothing now, the cost of inaction is going to mount and mount and mount. And so how do we get the nation to understand that? It couldn't be more stark the way this report reads. And I encourage everyone to read this report. It couldn't be more stark. How can we get the nation moving on this?
Yeah, I'm not sure. We have a big focus on working with local media to help them produce really scientifically accurate feature stories that explain and put climate change into context. I agree with the approach of not using the expression climate change very often. That has become a word that means to many people something political. And there are a lot of people who are very concerned about sea level rise and who are very concerned about the effects of our carbon emissions on temperatures and sea levels, who would prefer not to say climate change because that is a word that is now associated very heavily with liberals and with Al Gore and so forth. So I think that the key is really to be having lots and lots of these types of conversations where we're talking about stats and we're talking about long-term planning and long-term economic interests and really the well-being of Americans, because a lot of the pressure against discussing and preparing for climate change is really coming from a very short-sighted and short-term economic perspective. The threat to Americans, to their health, to their livelihoods, to their property, to their pocketbooks, to their infrastructure are just so great that we need to be having a conversation about this and helping people kind of wrap their heads around it and start to comprehend the scale of the challenge and, you know, frankly, get them excited about tackling this as a nation-building exercise rather than something to kind of cower from and fear and kind of huddle in the corner. But, you know, really get proactive and figure this out.
The fourth National Federal Climate Assessment is out. It's the culmination of years of research by hundreds of climate scientists, the most comprehensive federal climate report to date. The findings: climate change already causing more frequent and severe weather across this country. We are poised to suffer massive damage to our infrastructure, our ecosystems, our health, and the economy if global climate is allowed to warm up unchecked. What are your thoughts, questions, comments as we speak with John Upton, features journalist at Climate Central? It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Crystal is in St. Augustine. Hi, Crystal. Good morning.
Hi. First of all, I love the way your guest phrased our need to be excited about tackling this. I feel like that kind of gets lost a lot of time. You also touched on this a little bit, but I am curious, you know, what is it actually going to take? This is from Trump government agencies, and yet I feel like it's just going to be completely lost on him and on most people that are, you know, that are his fans. Is this report going to actually make any difference to the people that are making policy that just, as your guest said, don't believe in climate change?
Yeah. Thanks, Crystal. You know, it will be curious to see the dynamic in January, John Upton, when the Democratic Party takes over the U.S. House of Representatives. Some of the more progressive members of that new caucus are calling for what's known as a Green New Deal, phasing out fossil fuels, aggressively converting the country to renewable energy and other measures. What about the politics of this? On the left, you see this. On the right, there will be resistance to a Green New Deal. What's politically possible?
Look, there's resistance on the left to a Green New Deal. Neither political party has really woken up to the reality of the scale of these threats. They're both very heavily financed by fossil fuel interests, which have an interest in not addressing this problem. So we'll see what happens. It's just it's a small handful of these kind of radical Democrats that have started winning elections, and there's a handful of them who are now going into Congress, and they're starting to talk about a big public works plan where we just do everything that we can to get off fossil fuels, to get away from the pipelines that keep on kind of exploding beneath our feet, to get away from these huge power plants, these fossil fuel power plants that pollute our air, and in doing so, shift our, have a big infrastructure change where we're very aggressively pursuing a new approach to how we produce and generate and distribute electricity in America. And, really, if you look at any of the kind of scientific warnings about the rates of change that we can expect in the future, if we continue doing what we're doing right now, which is kind of the which is, you know, the Republican approach, but it's also pretty close to the Democrat approach. If we continue doing that, we're just going to see worse and worse impacts. And by the time we finally wake up to it and start, you know, really acting on it, it's going to cost much, much more. So we'll see how the dynamics play out in the next 2 years in Washington. I don't think anybody really knows what to expect, but we do now have a very small chorus of Democrats who are, you know, beating the drum about a very radical solution to a very pressing, urgent, and dangerous problem that we're facing.
And this whole idea of a Green New Deal is seen as radical by many in Washington and certainly the business community. Is what they're doing with this is just sort of moving the Overton window of what's acceptable, what's considered mainstream, is suggesting an idea and or a series of ideas, rather, that are really probably not feasible, but they're moving the Overton window of discussion over to that side of the ledger to make some of these ideas, I would think, at least a little bit more in the mainstream conversation. Is that the tactic? Is that what's happening with this?
Well, I think you've characterized it very nicely. You know, there is now a small group of people who are championing an idea that seems radical right now, and by definition it is. You know, it's very different to the system that we have right now. But, you know, the net benefits economically, in terms of health, in terms of all sorts of things, when you start looking at it that way, it's not really so radical. It's just a sensible approach to managing our infrastructure in the 21st century. So by having this group of Democrats out talking about this idea, sure, you know, they might not get the vote to do anything in the next couple of years. Who knows? But you're right. It is shifting the debate. It's shifting what's considered to be central, and it's really shifting people's perspectives when it comes to thinking about these things and what might be possible.
Jason is in San Marco. Hi, Jason. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for letting me speak this morning. And I just wanted a couple things. Number one, I mean, the Pentagon years and years ago said that climate change was a threat to national security. We've had the state of Florida has had a chief executive who's completely been in denial over this entire issue for the 8 years that he's been in charge. And now we're sending him on to the Senate, where he'll be able to make a lot more poorly informed decisions. We could have turned dealing with this issue into the greatest jobs creating program probably and possibly in our nation's history, and we've done nothing. So I hate to say it, but we're kind of going to have to sleep in the bed we've made. But this is not new, right? This is not a new story. This climate science has been out there for roughly 20 years, going back almost to the late 80s when the NASA scientists started discovering that our glaciers were disappearing, which is the planet's thermometer, so to speak. I really appreciate you bringing it out there. I hope we can find a way to solve this issue. I think that it could be a great job creator between a public and a private partnership to start dealing with the issue now. And I want to say that on your television network, they're showing a fantastic series called Sinking Cities, which shows you that the rest of the world is fully engaged in this problem. We are the country that pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord, thanks to President Twitterer-in-Chief, and for really no reason. It was a monetary reason, and now we realize that the cost of doing nothing far outweighs the cost of taking action. Thanks again. I hope you have a great day.
Thank you, Jason. And yes, Sinking Cities is airing on PBS stations. John Upton, I'm sure you're familiar with that. It looks at the effects of climate change in Miami, Florida, New York, London, and Tokyo, I believe, four of the world's great cities. Here's a tweet, by the way, when you talk about the politics of this. Josh tweets the show, climate change has been politicized, so we need to reframe the issue. And there need to be Republican leaders who lead on this, because studies show that conservatives will support climate adaptation policies if they're proposed by Republicans. John Upton.
I'm sorry. The depoliticization issue is obviously crucial. It's true that Republicans, when they're polled, are much more likely to say that they don't believe in climate change than they are to say that they want to act on climate change. It's this kind of inconsistency that the word climate change has just become so political that people don't want to be associated with it. But at the same time, I talk to people who do not want to say climate change. They see that as a liberal code word. They do want to talk about the issue. They just don't want to use that expression. So I am very optimistic that, you know, there's a lot of people at the grassroots level across this country, across the political spectrum, who want to be doing something about this. But the debate has become so mired and so deep at the kind of the national level that it's just very difficult to talk about.
Bill on the South Side. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I have 3 points. The first point is that I think you should have Philip Levine on your program, the former mayor of Miami Beach, former candidate for governor. He took steps in Miami Beach to thwart rising sea level, and you should find out what he did and what the effect of those are.
Yeah, he was on this show, actually, when he was running, and he's part of what's known as the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Compact bill, where all of the South Florida counties and bipartisan leadership, they've gotten together. They're already embracing aggressive adaptation and mitigation policies down there. So, yes, I am aware of that. But go ahead.
Okay, the second point is that recently in the New York Times, I read an article that when there are storms and things that we've had, that the government agency that controls rebuilding doesn't take any steps to build, to stop building in areas that are prone to flooding. And the Congress has no control over that program. And it's billions of dollars that needs to be controlled and needs to move people back from the water's edge. The third point is that I think your speaker is wrong when he says that Democrats are the same as Republicans. You had Ms. Ortega-Cortez in a sit-out in Nancy Pelosi's office to fight climate change. There's a big difference between the parties.
Okay, thanks for all of that, Bill. John, when we talk about moving people away from the coasts, I think that that's a harder conversation in this state, perhaps, than almost any other, because people move here specifically so that they can enjoy the coastline, they can build on the coast, they can enjoy a state without a state income tax, lower property taxes, and so on. And so as I read through this climate report, the picture that's painted is that if states like Florida don't begin now to start encouraging people to move in from the waterline and everything just goes on business as usual, eventually what will happen is almost a panicked abandonment of their property and insurance actuaries saying, sorry, we can't insure your property anymore. You're uninsurable. And then you'll see this devastating cascade of economic effects when the insurance companies pull out. And when I've interviewed people in the insurance business, they won't talk about this publicly, but they will say privately that they're already making those calculations about managed retreat and about figuring out how to, you know, tactically withdraw from a state like Florida that's so vulnerable. And so can you share a little bit about what you know about that piece of this?
So much of the flood insurance in the U.S. is subsidized by the federal government and also operated by the federal government, the National Flood Insurance Program. This program has actually been encouraging home building and real estate transactions in very vulnerable areas because property owners don't have to pay the full price for their insurance when it comes to flood hazards. For years, Congress has been talking about reforming this program. If we ever actually see those reforms occur, then we could see flood insurance rates increase very dramatically. We could see less flood insurance available. Much more of the insurance would be left to the private industry, which might not have any interest in insuring in these dangerous areas. And when that happens, that could very well be the trigger that that suddenly pushes a lot of people away from their coastal homes. If they can't afford the flood insurance, and then they have a storm or they have a high tide flood, or they can't afford to rebuild, then what are we left with? We're left with a lot of blighted properties along the coastline. Blighted properties obviously are not good when it comes to the property values of their neighbors. They blight kind of spreads disease if mosquitoes get in there and so forth. So it's not an attractive proposition to start talking about how do we plan, how do we decide which areas we want to build in and which areas we want to kind of abandon. But it's if we don't have this conversation, if we don't proactively make these decisions, then nature is going to make those decisions for us.
Dave on the south side. Hello, Dave. Good morning.
Morning, Melissa. It's Dave here. I've been fighting the climate wars now for 24 years in this state, and the battle scars that I've incurred give me, I think, some credibility to make about 3 points. One, we can think globally and act locally, and we have a very powerful local utility, JEA, that's currently undergoing a rethinking of its mission and its business strategy. And I would encourage all of your concerned readers to engage with JEA and encourage the JEA board, which meets tomorrow at noon, to hire a new CEO who understands the science, accepts the facts, and is willing to help Jacksonville Electric Authority develop a 21st century business strategy with the goal of having this community become a zero net carbon community. Zero net carbon is the buzzword.
Okay. Thanks, Dave. Yeah, I got you. And we're a little short on time, but let me ask John Upton, the role of a utility like our JEA in all of this. John.
Absolutely crucial. People lament the lack of federal leadership on this, and that's a legitimate thing to gripe about. It's really very unusual that a federal government would be doing so little to protect its people from such a tremendous and well-understood threat. But when you look for examples of communities that are doing a lot to, reduce their climate impact, but also adapt to climate change, this is really happening at the local level. This is where people see these impacts with their own eyes. All climate change impacts tend to be very localized, so it's different everywhere. So people across America are seeing these impacts. They're coming together with their local leaders, and they're doing stuff. They really are legitimately doing things at the utility level, at the municipal level, and oftentimes at the state level. And this is really where we're going to see the solutions to climate change emerge. There is an idea that, it's kind of a more liberal perspective, which is that you have a top-down approach where the federal government, issues, rules and imposes taxes and so forth to try to change behaviors. What we're seeing in America is a very different approach. It's more localized. It's from the local levels. And that's really, there's a lot of exciting things happening here, and there's a lot of potential for real and important change at that level.
I encourage everyone to read the 4th Annual National Climate Assessment Report. And I thank you, John Upton, features journalist with Climate Central, for getting on the phone with us to share your insights as well. Thanks for being on the show.
Nice to be with you again.
And much more still ahead. Later, the Jaguars rack up their 7th straight loss. Culpepper will be along with a look at that. It's becoming like a broken record. But up next, how to do Cyber Monday right. Whether you're at your desk at work, planning to go home later today, maybe from your phone, we have some tips on this Cyber Monday. We'll be right back.
Ansbacher Law. When buying or selling real estate, a board-certified real estate attorney can help transactions go smoothly and protect your interests. Barry Ansbacher, Florida Bar, board-certified in real estate law since 1995. More at 737-4600 or ansbacherlaw.com.
ServPro of Jacksonville South and Arlington are proud to support the J.T. Townsend Foundation, helping children and adults living with disabilities on the First Coast. Learn more or donate at jttownsendfoundation.org.
Citizens Property Insurance. Whether recovering or preparing, Citizens is available. Claims can be tracked at citizensfla.com or reported 24/7 by calling a live Citizens representative.
Support WJCT this Giving Tuesday. Tell the world that you believe in public media and trust us to bring the best in news, arts, education, and inspiring programming to the First Coast. Visit wjct.org/give.
Hi, I'm Andrew Wickman, host of Blues Horizon. The best in classic and modern blues is now on twice a week. Blues Horizon, Monday and Wednesday nights at 11, right here on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, Cyber Monday is here. And according to a new survey, more than 20% of American consumers say they will do most of their holiday shopping today online. Of course, Cyber Monday is the big day when retailers offer those enticing deals and one-day-only pricing for some of the hottest gadgets and gifts out there this holiday season. But before you hand over your credit card information on your website of choice, take a moment to be safe. Here with some tips is Ed Bitas, Bank Security Officer with Florida Capital Bank. Hey, Ed, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being with us. You know, this is something I think about a lot when I'm holiday shopping or just going on websites, any website that wants my credit card. But today is the big day. Mm-hmm. Millions of Americans will be doing this. So what do they need to know? What are some important tips?
Well, the biggest thing is that, you know, today will be the best day to go shopping out there. They'll have all kinds of specials. However, we do at least notify a lot of our folks, our customers and so forth, and let them know, be safe when you go online. The biggest thing on there is that when you go to websites, there's a lot of enticing things there, and some of them are sometimes too good to be true. Mm-hmm. So things that you want to look out for is like on the web address bar, make sure that it says HTTPS, S standing for secure. That means that you are connected securely and safely with that website.
If it's HTTP, it's not secure?
Sometimes it can't be, because the thing is that there's, places you can make a fake web address and make it emulate. A lot of people, what they call screen scrape, places like Macy's or whatever, and make it look like it's theirs, and it's not. It may go somewhere out of the country. So the biggest thing there is just looking at that address bar, making sure it starts with a HTTPS.
HTTPS is critical. What else?
The other thing, too, is also double check. If it looks too good to be true, sometimes call the store. Ask them. They're more than happy to give you their website address because they want those sales. They'll tell you the correct web address that you need to go to get their best bargains.
People are often reluctant to put their credit card information
absolutely
onto websites. Mm-hmm. But of course, this is the day when you're being encouraged to do that.
Absolutely.
How can you be sure that your information won't be stolen or misused?
Well, the biggest thing on there is the major thing that we tell everyone, especially our customers, don't use your debit card. Reason why is because when the money's gone, it's gone. With a credit card, at least you have some repercussions. You can go ahead and dispute the charge and so forth. And a lot of times you can get that money back with the credit cards.
That's good. That's important. Mm-hmm. Ed also says never submit your information over public Wi-Fi.
Absolutely. The thing is it's wonderful. Anywhere you go, there's free public Wi-Fi anywhere. It's great to use for research and price checking and so forth. But once you're ready to start buying that stuff, that's where you need to go ahead and get it secure. A lot of the times we tell you to go ahead and use the hotspot off of your cell phone because your cell phones are secure connections, or go to a website that's secure where you have to put a password to get onto their network.
Now, are there any scams going around this year on Cyber Monday people should know about?
Absolutely. There's so many that's out there, but a good resource that's out there is the FTC.gov website. They purposely go out there and look for sites, and then they go ahead and inform you of what's happening, how they steal your information, and what you need to do to report it.
Okay. Last but not least, Ed says, consider freezing your credit. What is that all about?
Absolutely. September of this year, there was a new law that was passed out to where the three top credit agencies can now offer you free credit freezes to your account. They didn't used to do this. They used to charge you for it. Now it's free, part of that law. And what that does is just if you feel like your account has been breached or somebody has stolen some information, you can freeze your account. So if anybody tries to open any new accounts under your name, they'll have to contact you first.
Okay. Are there any downsides to doing that?
No, not really.
Not really.
The best things about that is that they give you the opportunity to be able to take that credit freeze off with no issue, no problems. Now, we even go a step further, and a lot of the hackers are now starting to use the children's credit because it's free and clear. It's clean. There's no issues. So we also inform people, if you're going to go ahead and freeze your credit, freeze your child's credit. Because there's no need at 12 years old or whatever to have a credit card. They're not shopping. They're still with you.
Yeah.
So the thing is they shouldn't be getting a credit card. And by freezing your children's credit, you determine when you can open it up for them.
Okay. Any other advice on this Cyber Monday?
Basically, just being safe. Again, the biggest issue there is just make sure you don't use your debit card online because you can lose your money immediately there. Go to reputable websites. FTC.gov is a great resource, or actually going to the store or calling the store and asking what the website is.
Ed Bitas, he's Bank Security Officer for Florida Capital Bank. Happy shopping. Thanks,
Ed.
Thank
you.
More shopping ideas up next from Flamingo Magazine and later Culpepper as the Jaguars lose again. We'll be right back.
WJCT thanks the following business partners for their generous support. Jenkins Quality Barbecue, Gene C. Coker, PA, Florida Capital Bank. For more information, contact Anna Marie Stanford at 358-6390.
Amelia Island Museum of History presents the 12th Annual Holiday Home Tour, featuring five holiday homes in Fernandina Beach on November 30th and December 1st. Information at ameliamuseum.org.
That sound means you're in the Electro Lounge, where fresh, down-tempo, chill-out, and new jazz music plays Monday through Saturday nights at 9 p.m. only on 89.9 FM WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, if you're interested in buying local or at least from Florida makers this holiday season, Flamingo Magazine has you covered. It's the statewide magazine covering all things Florida, based right here in Ponte Vedra. Publisher Jamie Rich is here with the Flamingo Gift Guide shopping list. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. So you're out with your holiday gift guide, and this is really an emphasis on local and Florida-made gifts, which is great.
Yes, exactly. This gift guide is really kind of a spinoff of our regular editorial section, Made in Florida, where we highlight different makers, sunshine-inspired items and companies that can be producing anything from water bottles to boats to clothing. It's really all kind of generated, though, out of that Florida lifestyle. And the gift guide is especially, you know, highlighting those things that are great to give during the holidays. And a lot of our featured gift guide items are actually from our area in North Florida, but like you said, all over the state. So it goes from Central Florida, excuse me, down to South Florida. And they all kind of talk to or speak to that Florida lifestyle, whether it's, you know, polo shirts or our local Congaree pin, making the, you know, the grits and the pecan oil and even a shrub for your bar. So we really have a lot of cool items that I can talk to.
Yeah, you've got in your list is Congaree and Pen, Bold Bean Coffee, great selection, Underwoods Jewelry, and some other local business names that people will recognize, and also Ice Mule. This is Florida's answer to the Yeti. I hadn't heard about this.
Yeah, this is a really cool company. They're one of my favorites, actually. It's been one of my favorite gifts to give, actually, throughout the whole year. But forget about the Yeti. It's so heavy. I know everybody's really into it. I like Yetis, but who can carry that thing to the ball game or on your boat or, you know, even just to a backyard barbecue? But the Ice Mule Cooler, it's designed, it's you know, created by a guy out of St. Augustine, and really out of that whole lifestyle of being on the go, being in the outdoors, doing outdoor pursuits, and wanting something that he could carry that would keep drinks ice cold for 24 hours. And it's really designed like a wet bag, or I'm sorry, a dry bag to keep everything inside dry. And then you can put it on your back like a backpack. They have small ones all the way up to the Pro, which you can take on excursions, and it's really cool. Mm-hmm.
Now, in addition to the holiday gift guide, Jamie, inside the new issue of Flamingo Magazine, you've got everything from a section called The Tide, holiday-inspired events around the region, just hatched new openings, new restaurant openings in North Florida, even some cocktail and mocktail recipes for your next party. So this is a really cool holiday issue, and it's so exciting that Flamingo is published in Jacksonville and is distributed all over the state. I'm just so impressed with what you've accomplished with this magazine.
Well,
it's cool.
Melissa.
It's really cool.
We have a lot of fun just digging up stories, meeting people, and spreading the word around the whole state. And that's really one of the cool things about being based in Northeast Florida, as it's not just about highlighting the events. Like, we have this really cool event taking place in Fernandina Beach in a couple of weeks called Dickens on Center, and it's kind of a European old world Christmas time weekend, which is one of my favorite things to do during the holidays. But it's kind of also about spreading the word about Northeast Florida to the rest of the state. So it's not just, hey, guys in Jacksonville, look what you can do in Tampa or Miami or Tallahassee or what else is happening in the state. But hey, everyone else in Florida, look at what we're doing in Jacksonville. Look at all these cool makers. Look at all these cool products. Look at our events. You know, we have a lot of rich cultural activity springing out of our area. And so it's exciting to be located here, to spread the word around the state, and to highlight the people not only in our area, but, you know, everyone else.
Yeah. It is amazing, and I hope it encourages people to check out these other happenings around the state, maybe do a day trip, and encourages people from other parts around the Sunshine State to come up here and see what's happening here. And you can always give the gift of Flamingo as well.
That's
for
right.
The holidays.
It's a great gift, the subscription to Flamingo. Our new issue will actually be hitting newsstands probably anytime between today and the first week of December, but people are already receiving them in their mailboxes for the winter edition. But you can still subscribe. You can still give the gift. It's a perfect thing for that Floridian in your life, whether they live here in the state or they're somewhere else and they just feel tied to it and they want to reconnect. But people just love the idea of a state magazine that they can really turn to and curl up with a good story on their couch or on the beach or wherever they might be, on an airplane maybe.
That's where I tend to read magazines the most. Yeah.
And you can check it all out online. Our gift guide, everything that I mentioned today, the gift guide is online live this morning. Our new issue is launching. We're doing our big cover reveal on Instagram and Facebook. So please follow us there at The Flamingo Mag. And, you know, I didn't get to talk about too many of the local items, but we have a lot of local makers and cool things on there. Great gifts that I love personally and that I know you're loved ones and friends and people in your life would also appreciate getting. So, and there's a little story behind each one. So
that's
check
right.
it out.
You've got to pick up the magazine to learn more. And just in time for the holidays, it's on newsstands in a few days. So publisher Jamie Rich, it's Flamingo Magazine. Thanks as always. Happy holidays.
Thank you, Melissa. Happy holidays to you.
And in a moment, Culpepper as the Jaguars rack up another loss. Yes, we'll be right back with that.
The Orange Brick Custom House, built in 1891, is one of the most recognizable buildings in Key West. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll visit the Custom House, home of the Key West Museum of Art and History. We'll discuss the history of Hi-Li in Florida and food history in Miami. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
In Mississippi, a fight over the final undecided Senate seat is marred by racist remarks.
I don't know what's in your heart, but we all know what came out of your mouth.
This comment was twisted,
and it was turned into a weapon to be used against me.
We've got the latest on the race between Mike Espy and Cindy Hyde-Smith. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, breakthroughs in our understanding of the immune system and how the body fights disease and heals itself, or attacks itself, and how stress, sleep, and state of mind figure into the immune system's functioning. We talk with Daniel M. Davis, author of The Beautiful Cure. He's a professor of immunology at the University of Manchester in the UK. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world. On the next Fresh Air, breakthroughs in our understanding of the immune system and how the body fights disease and heals itself, or attacks itself, and how stress, sleep, and state of mind figure into the immune system's functioning. We talk with Daniel M. Davis, author of The Beautiful Cure. He's a professor of immunology at the University of Manchester in the UK. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, the Jaguars hit a low point in their seventh straight loss.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
But before we get to that, some breaking news about the franchise. Culpepper is here now with what's happening right now. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Yeah, within the last 5 minutes, an ESPN report is out from Adam Schefter, a typically very reliable source on these sorts of things, saying that the Jaguars are firing offensive coordinator Nathaniel Hackett. If you watched the game yesterday, you saw the most possibly conservative game plan you can imagine. Listen, Nathaniel Hackett is going to be the first of probably several moves that are going to happen with his Jaguars coaching staff. Usually what happens when you have a very disappointing year and one side of the ball is particularly awful, you're going to see some heads roll as far as assistants. You don't usually fire the head coach first unless it's something egregious. It has not been egregious from Doug Marrone's approach in terms of the way he's done things. Obviously, it hasn't been as successful this year. But Nathaniel Hackett gone. We'll see now what happens in terms of the play calling and that sort of thing. Doug Marrone, of course, has an offensive background. He's been an offensive line coach. He's spent time. He's been an offensive guy. So he may take greater control of the play calling going forward. But I can tell you it's not just the play calling that's the problem. It's also the development of the quarterback. Blake Bortles has taken a huge step back this year. A lot of that is on both the offensive coordinator and on the quarterback's coach. He hasn't had much help around him. There are a lot of issues on the offensive line. It was very clear yesterday that the Jaguars were unable to block consistently in the passing game. The Buffalo defense, their hands were tied with some extent. And what was working was the running game. They did a very good job running the football with Leonard Fournette. At one time, I think they ran 19 running plays out of 20 at one point. But then the low point of the season, at least to this point, happened late in the third quarter. Game tied at 14. The Jaguars had not thrown a pass that was caught by a wide receiver all game until Blake Bortles connected with Dante Moncrief on a play down the sideline. It was originally ruled a touchdown. It would later be overturned and said it was down to the one-yard line. But Moncrief and the Bills defender were laying on the ground right at the edge of the end zone, both hanging onto the football. Moncrief didn't want to let go of it. The defender didn't want to let go of it. A little childish on both parts probably because the whistles had already sounded. They'd already called it a touchdown. But that created a soup ready for a fight, and Leonard Fournette came racing off the sideline. He was not in on that play, came all the way across the field, started, as he said, getting his teammates back with some pushing and shoving. Then he started throwing punches against Shaq Lawson, the linebacker for the Buffalo Bills. He was ejected, and the Jaguars' offense just didn't have enough after that. They wound up not scoring a touchdown on that drive, actually missing a field goal. And that was pretty much the low point of the game and the season. And afterwards, Doug Marrone and Fournette both had to talk about what was really an embarrassing moment in the year.
27 was ejected for throwing a punch. He came over to the sideline. You know, obviously, I talked to him. He's a captain. He can't do that. You know, obviously, that's something that hurts our team, you know, when we lose probably our best offensive player who was playing, you know, obviously at a very high level.
Your brother getting attacked, you're fighting out there, man. You're going to have to go out there and also protect your own, you know, but at the same time, it's a professional now, you know what I mean? You can't have that. You know, I apologize to all the kids out there who look up to me, you know, and all our fans. But the biggest thing is, man, like I said, this whole this loss totally on me. I take full responsibility for that.
Yeah, he's right. As a captain, you cannot act that way. Just a side note, why do NFL players who get in fights start swinging punches with bare hands at helmets? I never got that. Don't understand.
I guess the adrenaline takes over.
Happened with both guys. I mean, you know, why
that's
do you
not punch? Yeah, they didn't think that through so well.
No,
yeah.
There's a better way to do that. Fournette could be suspended this week, potentially by the National Football League. Will certainly be fined. And the Jaguars right now, if the season were to end today, would have the sixth overall pick in the NFL draft, and there are still five games to go, so we'll see if this thing gets any better before it gets worse.
It's got to get depressing for you to be covering this season as we go, as it moves towards its sad conclusion.
Well, it's a different kind of season to cover than last year, that's for sure, but I keep reminding myself this, Melissa, I'm still undefeated.
That's right. Okay, let's talk a little bit about UF beating FSU over the weekend.
Big win. I was there in Tallahassee for a very impressive second half for the Gators, who ran away from the Seminoles in a 41-14 victory, snapping a five-game losing skid in the series, and also ending Florida State's 36-year bowl streak. It was the longest in college football. It is now gone with a 5-7 record. There's some major issues that need to be addressed at Florida State as Willie Taggart heads into his first offseason after his job. But you compare these two coaches, Dan Mullen at Florida, Willie Taggart at Florida State. There's no doubt that Mullen is leaps and bounds ahead of where Taggart is. An unfortunate side effect of this, some of the passion of college football perhaps wrapped into some other issues. There was a Florida State, I'm going to call him a fan for lack of a better term, who posted a meme on social media of Taggart, who is a black man, being lynched. And the university responded pretty quickly to that. Listen, I'm all for being a fan of your team, but obviously there are some deeper issues there and something that the university has to address right away.
Absolutely. Okay. Georgia getting ready for Alabama in the SEC title game. What are their chances?
Well, last year, you might recall, in the national championship game, it went down to an overtime play and a last-second win for Alabama over Georgia. Alabama looks even better this year than it did a year ago. Georgia is playing very well. Also, Georgia knows that if they're going to get back to the college football playoff, they have to beat Alabama to secure a spot. It's going to be a tough one. Right now, Alabama, Clemson, Notre Dame seem to have pretty good spots in the college football playoff. Then the question is, who would be the fourth? If Georgia were to beat Alabama, could knock the Crimson Tide out, and maybe UCF could sneak their way
could
in.
Sneak in.
We'll see. They've lost their quarterback to a season-ending injury.
Follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper. Check him out tonight with Mark Brunell on the CW and every night on Channel 4. Thanks, Cole.
Thanks, Melissa.
I'm Melissa Ross, and 1A is up next. Thanks for listening to 89.9. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.